everyone. Welcome to another edition of Big Chris Live, the live stream, and then the podcast, which you can find everywhere, virtually everywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and our podcast network host, DeanBlundell.com, where you can find all sorts of other great content creators, as they say, for the unrefined gentleman. On that website. We're joined by a special guest this evening, special for a bunch of different reasons, very topical as well. And the connection is that this is my best friend's dad. But Rick Revell is a bit more than just my best friend's dad. He is an author. The fourth book is coming out this year, right,
Rick? August, yeah.
August, we can expect the new book. I Am Algonquin was the first one. I've got a signed copy here, and I'm excited to have you on, Rick, because, you were one of the people that I wrote down as, you try and make a list of interesting people when you're starting a podcast, interesting people that you think might have some great stories to tell. And I did write you down on that list. And now that, national headlines are surrounding, indigenous children and residential schools, I thought, I would love to get your take on this, because here's the other thing. The whole time that I've known Rick as my best friend's dad, Rick, I've never ever heard you make any statement about residential schools or about the indigenous community at large. I mean, you're very much into the history and the storytelling of it, which is why you're a novelist. But I'm curious about your take on the national news that's broken over the last couple of weeks, the things that a lot of Canadians have had their eyes opened up to.
Well, none of my family's ever been in residential schools. And I asked my mother, she just passed away 2 years ago, and I asked her about that. Mm-hmm. She said, my grandmother was really good at hiding them in the haystacks. They were trained when they lived in Perth, Ontario, that if anybody strange came up the laneway, they had to run to the barn and hide in the haystack. And mom said, that's why we never ended up having to go off the farm. This was in the 30s and in the 40s. So, this the residential school is not new news. Indigenous people for years have been trying to tell people about it, and whether nobody listened or wanted to listen. Truth and Reconciliation brought out a lot about the residential schools, about the pain and suffering that was going on. Mm-hmm. A lot of books have come out. And the colonialists keep saying, all you want to do is cancel history, cancel culture. No, that's not what it's all about. They have to really, it all goes down to these Sir John A. Macdonald statues. And I say all the time, Sir John A. Macdonald is a hero to the white people, not a hero to anybody else. He's their hero. Okay. They like to celebrate his birthday. They like to celebrate his death. And when they're doing that, they're celebrating his brutality too. Even though they say they're not, they are. Because if you're celebrating a man like that, you're celebrating his brutality. They like to pass it off that, it was the day and age. He was racist because of that. Well, that's inexcusable, really, as far as I'm concerned. The residential schools is a blot on this country, a big blot. When you have to, and all the research that I've done in writing is in pre-contact and contact, the most important thing to a Native community was their children. They were a gift from Kichi Manitou. That was their generation. That was their next generation. That was their life going forward. And once MacDonald took that generation, those generation years out of there, he was taking the language, he was taking all the knowledge away from everybody. And it's only been in the last 5 or 10 years that a lot of Indigenous people have been brave enough to stand forward and come forward, write books. There was a guy that retired from Toronto Star as a writer, and he had a great, great quote. He was Asian, Indian from Asia, and he said, "Beware of the indigenous youth because they're getting educated, and once they get educated, they're going to want what's due them, and if you don't give what's due them, they're going to take it from you. And if you see all of these statues being pulled down and all of these protests, a vast, vast majority of the younger indigenous youth."
So you see that as the bill has come due?
Yes, I do. And indigenous youth have seen how the pain that their parents and their grandparents went through, and they're not going to take it. It's just that saying that they're going to ask for what to do then if they're not going to get it, yeah. They're gonna take it. And they've got the intelligence. We got there's lots of lawyers being educated and teachers now in the indigenous community. I have to, I printed this off to you. I have to read this to you. This was during the Truth and Reconciliation, and CBC put it out last week in a tweet, and it's kind of brutal. But it really says what happened. And this testimony supporting the claims was at times shocking, and they're talking about Truth and Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Elder Irene Favo told a 1998 town hall forum. Now, this is 1998, 23 years ago. "I went to residential school in Muskowegan from 1944 to 1949, and I had a rough life. I was mistreated in every way. There was a young girl, and she was pregnant from a priest there. And what they did, she had her baby, and they took the baby and wrapped it up in a nice pink outfit. And they took it downstairs where I was cooking dinner with a nun. And they took the baby into the furnace room, and they threw that little baby in there and burned it alive. And all you could hear was this little cry, like, oh, and that was it. You could smell the flesh cooking. That's striking. That's devastating."
Yeah.
And CBC retweeted that the last week or so. And now this stuff is coming out and people are believing it. It took finding all these dead bodies buried without names, like in a mass grave, for people to finally realize all the pain that went on. And there's still people alive that were responsible for those residential schools, and they should be brought to justice. So the indigenous people are taking them to the United Nations Court, World Court, and it should be done.
That makes sense that there are people still alive today that were responsible, because they lasted at least in name until 1996. And I've mentioned this before, and I'll mention it again. Like, when I was younger, it was not taught in school. It was not something that we learned about in our history classes. You know, we learned about Upper and Lower Canada, and we learned about, you know, Confederation and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we did not learn any of that. But when 1996, I guess I would have been 15 years old. I remember asking my dad when that news came out that they were closing the residential schools, they were doing away with it. I asked my father, I said, what is that? And he explained it to me, maybe not in such graphic and brutal terms, but he explained to me how unjust it was. He explained to me how unfair it was. And he explained to me how long it had been going on. And so I had a base knowledge, but you know what? Not every teenager in 1996 asked their dad, and not every teenager in 1996 got the same answer as I did. And so Yeah, there are people out there, Rick, you're right, that are still walking, breathing as free people and have not answered the call for their complacency or involvement in it whatsoever.
I have to give her a lot of credit to the school boards now that they're teaching. Yeah. I work as a knowledge keeper within the Limestone District School Board and the Algonquin Lakeshore Catholic School Board. It's amazing the progress that they're making. And the young children are growing up to appreciate who Indigenous people are. Mm-hmm. And I have lots of – everything has a story with me. But I've been probably working in the school for 5 or 6 years. There's about 8 or 10 of us in the Kingston area, and we're all – I'm an author, and they all got different skills, like drummers and their craftsmen and Métis players. I was back at Granite Ridge, and that's in Charbot Lake. I was doing a thing in the library, and they're from JK to grade 12. And remember, I went to school. I didn't know I was Indigenous for a long time because my mother and my grandparents kept it secret. They hid out in Omaha.
Well, and that's how your ancestors never ended up in a residential school.
Yeah, well, they kept it pretty secret. They really did. Really kept it secret. And so you wouldn't even, if you were going to school like I did 60 years ago, I would have been in grade 4. You wouldn't have said you're made up, like, you know. So anyway, this little girl, I'm with a grade 2 class. We're in the library. This little girl, I'm 5 minutes in. She puts up her hand. I said, yes. And like I said, like with the young kids, it's either a story. They're going to tell you a story. They're going to ask you a question. She stood right up and she said, my name's Myra. And I'm an Algonquin person. Just like that. And I choked up. And she sat down. She was so proud. I was so proud that the teacher made that classroom feel so safe.
Yeah.
She stood up and said that. But it gets better. A couple minutes later, I talked. The teacher's got tears in her eyes. 2 or 3 minutes later, a little boy puts up his hand. He gets up and I forget what his name is. Let's say he's Billy. He said, my name is Billy. Myra's my friend and she's an Algonquin. And he sat down. I said, wow. This is amazing. 5 minutes later, another little girl puts up her hand. She stands up. She said, she told me her name. She says, my name is Sarah. Myra's my friend, and she's an Algonquin. Wow. And she sat down. That classroom felt so safe that girl could identify who she was, and all her friends could identify. You couldn't do that 60 years ago, Chris.
Yeah,
there's no way. The teachers, and I tell that story and I get some teary eyes from teachers, and I tell them how proud I am of the teachers that they make in their classrooms feel safe. I had another little girl. I was in Glenburnie Public School, or was it Joyceville Public, one of the schools, or a cat, no, maybe I got some in school, I think it was St. Margaret Musel. And I was telling the children why natives cut their hair the way they do. And there's reasons. Like I said, they didn't cut their hair then more. The Haudenosaunee didn't shave their heads, and the Hurons didn't shave their heads to look fierce. They shaved their heads because they lived in large communities, indoor and longhouses, and they shaved their heads because of head lice. That's why they shaved their head. And they bristled it with bear grease, and that kept it off. The women, they didn't shave their heads. They combed their hair by the fire and they picked out the head lice and that. The men were too busy hunting and protecting to worry about that. But my people, the Amawini, didn't live. We live in like little conical shaped wigwams, teepees or wigwams, and 4 or 5 to the family. Not so much lice there, but we shaved their heads on one side, depending if we're left or right-handed. Hmm. Or we would do hair up in a braid, like I have a big long braid at the back. And there was a reason for that. And the kids would look at me. I said, because if you're right-handed and you pull your bow back and you let the string go, your hair doesn't get caught up in it, in the long hair.
Right. And everything had a practical reason.
Yeah.
You know, a practical route method to the madness, if you will.
But once I told the story, this little girl had long hair. When I was leaving that day, and she told me she was Mohawk. When I was leaving that day, she came out, she had her hair in a braid. She says, the first time I've ever put my hair in a braid and decided I'm going to wear it the rest of my life.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, Rick, you know, what I love about, again, to your novels, I Am Algonquin. It was the first of the trilogy, and then the fourth is coming out, like you say, this August. I encourage people to go out and Google this. My mom, actually, believe it or not, my mom was on the phone with me today. She did not know that you were on the podcast tonight, but she specifically asked about the new book. So I know that she is especially interested in getting her hands on a copy this coming August. So, but what I love about this is it has been, and you've gotten heavily involved with schools and school boards with this literature. And I remember when you first wrote the first book, because like I said off the top, this is my best friend's dad. So, you know, I've been there for the journey. I remember when you first wrote that book, and then eventually the deal came, and then the school tours came where you would go and speak to classes. And I thought, and maybe I never told you this, but I thought that that was amazing. I thought it was exactly what we needed. And here we are all these years since 1996, since the residential schools and all that has gone away. Like you say, we have made some progress, haven't we? I mean, the fact that, that these kids, these anecdotal stories, and that, you know, that your books are, you've got a book deal and your literature is getting out there in the education system. That's a huge plus, and that's a huge win, I think.
Yes. Like, it surprised me, really, because I got published when I was 61 years old. We should tell your listeners what my books are about. 1300 is pre-contact. They're not about residential schools. They're
yeah,
about
this is way back. That's why I say I've always known you as, you know, into the history and the culture. Like my dad is big into, you know, all the Scandinavian history and traditions and, you know, and I'd love for you guys actually to get together one day because, you know, he likes to go out to, you know, a sweat lodge or sweat tent. And I don't know if he's doing ayahuasca or mushrooms out there. I don't know what he gets up to, but, you know, he goes out and he has meditation sessions and he's looking for visions and stuff. There's a lot of similarities when you come to some of these cultures, even though they're from completely opposite places. But I've always known you as a guy who has been about the real history and the rich history. And like you say, your books are pre-contact. And for those who don't know, by all means, you know, give us a synopsis.
Yeah. I got lucky at the first. I met a woman on LinkedIn. Her name was Marty Ford. She was the superintendent of the Frontier School Board in Manitoba, which is the largest geographical school board in Canada. She got the books in her class. She made sure the books went into her school board. And she sent me one line. And it really struck me. She said, Rick, I want to thank you for teaching our children the culture. And these were Native kids. And I thought, wow, yeah, that residential schools were a brick wall. And the elders haven't been around to teach them. Chris Reed, his name was Reed. He got my books before he retired, put all my books in all 60 libraries of the Limestone School District School Board, all three. Wow. And then it just started from there. And in the last 4 or 5 years, I've been going into schools. I have what I call a Native tickle bag and a Native tickle trunk full of furs and weapons. And we talk about the 1300s. The first book takes place in the Ottawa Valley, up where you're from.
Yeah, my home area, yeah.
Alamute Island, Morrison Island, the Ottawa Valley. I use the language in the vernacular. The languages are all sprinkled through the book. So that goes over good with the school boards. In this second book, it's about a family of Amawini, who we call, Algonquin people call ourselves, our proper name is Amawini. And through about 50 or 60 years. So the first book, second book starts in Newfoundland. Oh, yeah. The first book, I introduce you to legends. You get introduced to Mitigumish, who's a shapeshifter. He's Trickster Rabbit and his sidekick. He's Miju Piju, the fabulous underwater night panther. Second book starts in Newfoundland. You get introduced to Glooskap. Miju Piju, the fabulous underwater night panther, you can go to Mazinaw, Lake Mazinaw, and on the rocks there, there's a picture of him that's been there about 500 or 600 years ago. Glooskap, I humanize all these legends, which they are, they're shapeshifters. Glooskap, if you go to Truro, Nova Scotia, outside the Mi'kmaq Welcome Center, there's a 40-foot statue of Glooskap. These aren't pretend things. I write about true culture, actual places that you can actually travel to, like your hometown. A lot takes place up in Elmont.
Yeah.
The third book starts in southwestern Ontario, and you learn about Nanabush, who sleeps outside of Thunder Bay, the sleeping giant. The fourth book starts in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. Follows a family.
So I got a weird question, Rick, and I just Googled it just for a second there. You mentioned Glooskap, and that triggered something that I thought was correct, and I had to Google to make sure. But there is a theory out there, and you can scroll back to previous podcast episodes where we talk about the Curse of Oak Island. And we're talking about Templars visiting the east coast of Canada pre-Columbus, pre-discovery, and perhaps that the Templars came here, and that Glooskap, who you mentioned, was possibly the way he had a shimmering skin, right? Or he had a glow about him. Yep. That it perhaps was a European Templar in Templar armor. Do you know anything about that at all?
You've heard that story before. Glooskap is he had two dogs called Night and Day, one white and one black. Mm-hmm. He had Nukumus was his grandmother's sidekick, and he had a little sidekick named Martin. He was a small person. That's who he traveled with, and they all had powers. I never heard about the Templar thing. Glooskap was along pre-contact.
Yeah, well, that's the theory, is that the Templars had come here pre-contact.
Is that a white man's theory?
It was a, yeah, well, listen, when you're trying to figure out what's buried on Oak Island, you come up with a lot of crazy theories. Anyways, yeah. we can credit Kent Stewart with that theory that he pitched here. The Templars had built the treasure there. But anyways, back to your story. You have all these characters in your books, right?
Yeah. I always ask, I talk to elders or something before I write about them. I do a lot of research. So there's a guy in Lower Brewery Reserve in South Dakota. I went down there to do research. I didn't meet him. I met him, his cousin. I talked to him over the phone. His name is Rob Her Mini Horses. Interesting about his name, but if we have time later. I asked him, I said, I need to know about legends that you have because I want to include it in my book. So I said, well, we have Rabbit Boy. I said, well, I've already got a couple of those. He said, we have White Buffalo Calf Woman. And I said, that's too sacred to the Lakota people. I'm not going to talk about that. It's not in Lakota people. It says Big Elder Brother. I said, oh. So he told me a story about Big Elder Brother. So Lower Brew Reserve is the poorest reserve in North America. It's in South Dakota. So one July day, they're sitting on the library steps waiting for the library open, him and some buddies. And this white woman who had came from New York City, Rob said, to save the Indians here, was the librarian. And she was driving this Toyota and no paved roads. This was in the 80s. No paved roads. And she comes barreling down the road and the dust is just flying, Rob says. It's all over the place. She pulls up in the car, jumps out of the car, and she says to the boys, these Lakota boys sitting on his desk, we've got to call Sioux Falls. We've got to get their TV station here. We've got to get NBC here. And the guys are saying, Lakota guys are pretty laid back. They're pretty cool guys. And they said, oh, yeah. Okay. What's up? I seen Bigfoot. I seen him as I was coming into town. And the guy said, oh, yeah. Yeah. And she says, then she starts crying, Rob says, you don't believe me. They said, yeah, we believe you. We leave food outside the village for him all the time. He smells so bad, we don't want him in here. He's our guardian. He's been around for years. He comes through a portal. He's like a person like that. And she started bawling her eyes out. Didn't think they believed him. So she takes off in her car and never comes back. Rob says, that's how I got my first summer job. I was the librarian after that. So he told me this story. So I had to use Dig Elder Brother in the third book.
So that's a character in the third book then.
Yeah, and that's a true Lakota legend. That's Bigfoot. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's so funny, Rick, because not funny, but it's great that you have all these stories and that you're continuing on the tradition of telling these stories, because from my perspective, that was the worst part of looping back to where we started with the residential schools. It was an outright attempt to erase all of that. And it didn't get erased. I mean, maybe there was some parts erased, but it seems as though these legends, these stories are still continuing on. And that's positive to me.
Yes. Yeah. For me, as a writer, it was very important to find these stories and to talk to elders. And what's real important, Chris, I don't know if you realize this. When I wrote my first two books, I couldn't put the translations in because there was nobody that I could talk to that I could hear the words.
Hmm.
My second book, I did find a Mi'kmaq talking dictionary. Once the third book, I was able to put all the pronunciations in because the Mi'kmaq community listed these Quebec, run a talking dictionary. They have elders that bring them in once a month and they pronounce the words online, and you can type in the English word and you can hear it. In the University of Minnesota, they got a school there called the William Indian College. And the students there look after the Anishinaabe online talking dictionary. So I was really, really excited. I wrote the third book. It had the pronunciations. And that was kind of going to be the end. I had an open ending on it. Then, because I wanted to get the Anishinaabe Travels to the Rocky Mountains. Then, by a fluke, I found a Blackfoot talking dictionary, and it's ran through the University of Lethbridge. And it has all these amazing women elders and men elders that pronounce the Thiska language. And this has only happened in the last 4 or 5 years that they've been bringing in the elders that can talk the language. You'd be amazed. Like, the last I heard, but my friend Eddie Miracle has told me that there's about 1,200 Mohawks that can speak it fluently. Mm. And they're building a school in Tanganyika to teach the Mohawk language. They're getting some money. And the biggest problem after grade 4 or 5, they haven't got the teachers that can teach the Mohawk. It's like the Lakota, they got less than 1,000 fluent speakers.
Right.
And it goes on and on. And now they're bringing it back. They're putting it online so the language is there forever. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good and bad to internet. And I mean, obviously there's, you know, everything has been so divisive over the years. Now that everybody's online, everybody's on Twitter, everybody can voice their opinions and argue, and it's become exhausting, this internet, for a lot of people. They get tired. I was texting with someone today who said, yeah, geez, I wish we could just go back to flip phones. And yeah, I agree in some ways. But when you look at these examples, this is what the internet was for. You know, I think that's what the internet was truly actually created for, was that kind of use. The fact that there are languages that were on the verge of extinction, but now they're able to help rebuild them with the help of the internet and the collaborative sense of the internet and what it can accomplish, you know, with people in different locations. You say one place in Minnesota, you know, in this place, I mean, these are far, far distances, but the internet makes them not far at all. And you know, it's too bad that the internet got taken over by, you know, haters and porn and whatever, because that's truly what I think the internet was intended for.
Yeah. And Queen's University teaches Mohawk and Anishinaabe there now in the last 2 or 3 years. There's a woman named Maureen Buchanan. She runs a language nest in Weller Avenue.
Yeah.
She's Mohawk and Anishinaabe. There's so many good things happening now that people don't know about,
yeah.
But it's it's a little smudge. It's spreading and spreading and spreading.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions dating back to when we first started our conversation. We've been on such a journey already in the first half hour here, but you mentioned off the top, your family history, that they hid in haystacks and dodged these people coming for families. Do you feel lucky, or how do you feel about that? What's your reflection on that family history?
Lucky is just a word, I think, a lot. Fate. My mother was a single mother. My father was killed in 1953 when I was 8 months old in a car accident with my mother's first cousin. They had known she was Indigenous, I probably would have been taken right away with that in 1953. Mm-hmm. Lucky, fate, I don't know. They kept it so secret. My grandfather was a wonderful, wonderful man. If you look at pictures of my mother and her two brothers and grandfather when they were young, you could see they were Indigenous, but they kept their mouths shut. And Grandpa worked hard. They worked in the My grandmother was white, but I think her mother was Native. She was a Lapointe, but they were poor. They worked. They lived in tents and cooked and worked in the cook camps when they were putting hydro through Northern Ontario. And was able to scrape enough money together when he was 42 or 43 and bought a farm. And it was always that whisper when I was a kid. Always a whisper when I was a kid, and it was just kind of a fluky thing when I found out from a cousin who we were, and had my Native card within 2 weeks after that. I'm proud of who I am and tell everybody who I am.
Yeah, well, absolutely, Rick, as you should. And obviously you've got the vocals, so you've got the written word now that tells everybody who you are as well too. It's so such a great part of your identity, and you're one of the more richer people that I know. You enrich my life with that, whenever I hear or see you speak about it, it's always great to hear. Although there is obviously a lot of, darker and sadder things in that history. I always find a very positive outlook from you. So,
if you got another question, I got a story I have to tell when you're talking about. I'll go ahead and tell this.
Go for it, Rick.
These are my three books anyway. Great, great artist work by Dunder. And then the new book's coming out with Crossfield. It's called Algonquin Legacy. Then before we leave, I got to talk about my fifth book, which I'm really proud of.
Well, you see, this is the thing. You're still going. You're always cooking these stories up. That's what I'm talking about. You're rich. You're full.
My first book signing, I was doing a book signing in Belleville. For my first book. And I was proud of it, and I wanted to sell it. And a guy came up to me and he says, "You don't look Indigenous." I had short hair like this.
Yeah, right.
"You don't look Indigenous." I didn't know what to say because I wanted to sell the books, and said, "I'll buy a book from you anyway." Second time, Algonquin Spring, I had long hair and a ponytail down to my back. Nobody said a word to me. Nobody said a word. Didn't say I didn't look Indigenous or anything. Mm-hmm. Third time, same thing up in Belleville, signing the books. Guy came up to me and says, "You got blue eyes. You're not Indigenous." Then he said, "You don't look Indigenous." I said, "How did you want me to look? Should I have war paint on my face when I came in here?" "No, I don't really give a shit because I got three books out and nobody's going to push me around. I'm not." The guy kind of looked at me and he walked away. And so now I have a braid down my back. So I just turn around and walk away.
That braid pales in comparison. You had a much more fierce one not too long ago.
Yeah. My wife likes this one better. People expect you to look like, I don't know if you ever read Thomas King's books. He talks about, you look like a dead Indian. I mean, a dead Indian is like people that dress in regalia. Like he's a comic. He's a native guy that he's really funny. He used to have a Dead Dog Got Cafe, went with CBC. And I think a lot of people expect you to look like dead Indians, dressed in buckskin and paint on and riding a horse through the sunset. That's not what we are. You know, there's lots of people that live off the land. And that they expect, you have to have, people think you have to have a certain look. I have lots of friends that don't say that, but it's just like, you get people walking up to you and saying, geez, you don't look like, what?
Yeah, what does anything look like anymore? Yeah. That's the other thing.
Yeah, yeah. It makes me laugh. I usually laugh. What are you talking about? Anyway, I'll let you ask some questions here.
So I was going to ask, you've preserved a lot of this, but are you aware of anything that's been lost for good, permanently? Is there anything that we will never know?
There's lots of things that being discovered that we thought we didn't know. And archaeologists, people that study when they dig up burial sites and that, and there's lots of things coming forward. I always said, well, natives didn't scalp. That was a European. They dug up. I talk about it in one of my books, in the foreword or the epilogue or something. They found this area. And they traced it back to the 1300s, and there was 450 people in a mass burial site. They had been massacred and all scalped. As pre-contact, like 200 and some years pre-contact. And they're discovering things like that. They're discovering ancient civilizations here. And we have no written word, okay?
Yeah, and that makes a scene where a lot can be lost.
Yeah, and a lot got lost when the kids got put into residential school. The elders, there was nobody to tell the oral history to.
Yeah.
And there was some children that had to get taken away, and they were told, and they saved it, and that oral history was saved, but it wasn't as much as it should be saved. There's the travels of the Anishinaabe people that left they came from the west, from the east coast to the west coast, pre-contact and during contact, and they left all the paintings and around Peterborough and Niagara Falls and Mazinaw and that of their journey. We had a great civilization here. We had no jails. There was no theft. If you were hungry, people shared with you. We had enemies, we had allies, but we didn't have these great big huge battles like they had in Europe.
Yeah.
Open fields, because we could not afford to lose warriors. Like, we didn't have the slums of Paris or the slums of London, England to go get, because you lost 5,000 soldiers and you go start hauling people off the streets. We didn't have that. We respected life. Women had lots of power. And when the British came, that's when they started making chiefs start being elected, because they didn't want to talk to the women. They didn't want to negotiate with women.
Right.
The Haudenosaunee has got a rich history of the clan mothers, the Blackfoot. They were so well organized. They had their own police forces that controlled the hunts. They had that controlled everything in the village, that looked after everybody. Gay people, very important in society. In the Amawini society, if you were gay, you looked after elders. At my age, I'd be an elder. And maybe my son was passed away. Maybe I was the only one left. They would hunt for me. Gay people raised the orphans. If there was no family left, they raised the orphans. They were so important to the society. Gay in the Lakota, in the Cheyenne society, they were children of the thunder god, and we had religion.
Yeah,
and it was all there for us.
Yeah, and it's a shame that none of that got absorbed. You know, sometimes when you have cultures intermingling or, you know, as they did in Europe for centuries, you know, you would pick up different parts of each culture. I always think about when, you know, the Vikings came to the United Kingdom or into Britain, and how eventually, yes, there was some conflict, but at the same time, eventually it, some of their traditions and intermingled with the British traditions.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a shame that none of that really happened. It was not an intermingling at all. You know, and none of that really got absorbed. I mean, imagine that if some of those traditions or some of those, you know, ideas, societal ideas actually got absorbed into settlers, if there was a more peaceful transition, you know.
Just the healing, just the medicines that we knew about. One of the people that I worked with in the school board said we had a bit of a problem at one school because one teacher said that we were condoning tobacco use. I said, they don't understand. We didn't use our four medicines, tobacco, sweetgrass. This is the sweetgrass that I grow. We use it for smudging. It was used when a woman gave birth. It was used to stop vaginal bleeding. Mm-hmm. I have sage over here. We used it to smudge with, keep mosquitoes away. We make teas out of it.
Yeah.
And cedar, vitamin C, great tea. But tobacco, what we used tobacco for, we would carry it in our medicine bag. If I was wounded, I'd pop it in my mouth and chew on it and put it on my wound.
Yeah.
We would use it if you were an ally. I would send a runner to your village and say, Chris, we're going to war, or we're going on a big hunt. Will you take this tobacco as a gift and come and help us?
Right.
And maybe when you did come, we might smoke a pipe of it to thank the gods. That's it. We didn't stand outside a teepee with our legs crossed and smoke.
Well, you know what? That's all it takes to get me to go hunting, Rick. Just offer me some smoke. I'll be there in a jiff.
It's like we gave what the land gave us,
yeah,
and used it and looked after it.
Yeah.
The land was important to us. We wouldn't go in and wipe out a whole family of beavers. We would make sure that there was enough there for the next year. And we make sure that when we picked wild rice, that we threw enough wild rice back into the lake so it would grow.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think too that, you know, speaking of beavers, I mean, like, there wasn't an economy of tricorn hats that was demanding beaver pelts. That's the other thing too, you know, that was one of the things too that drove sort of the destruction of the land was the European economy that demanded things like beaver pelts and things of that nature, right?
Yeah, well, yes. And another thing, this is an interesting story.
Yeah.
So when the pilgrims came over, they were really religious. The natives didn't turn to religion, they cut their heads off. And like they brutalized them, they burnt them at the stake. Yeah. So the natives in the East Coast had wampum, beautiful wampum beads. And the purple beads were rare because when you found the sheep shells, you had that little bit of purple in it. So they started using it as a currency. So they capture native and say, we're holding him for ransom. We want five rolls of wampum for him.
Huh.
Weird. Until after about a year and a half, somebody in Europe started making counterfeit wampum that they had to quit using it as a currency. A lot of natives died because they'd capture them, and if you didn't get the wampum belts, they'd kill them or whatever. And this was on the East Coast in the 1600s. Like, it's just weird. We used it to tell stories. If they made a peace pact with somebody, they wove that story into the wampum belt and they gave it to you.
Yeah.
It was a sacred thing. So when the white people come, oh, we're going to use this for money, because they didn't have coins and that.
Right, right. They needed something to, yeah.
Yeah. And so they, you know, it's a true story, but it's weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, there's a lot of eye-opening things that we've learned that I think a lot of Canadians are learning. And back to, if I can loop back to the statue thing that's happening these days. I noticed that, you know, the Sir John A. statue is still standing in Kingston. I noticed today that there's a big movement afoot to have the statue removed at City Park in Kingston. I know that the students the people at Egerton Ryerson statue at Ryerson University got toppled the other day. The head was thrown into the lake. You know, what would you like to see happen? Would you like to see that statue removed? If so, how? Would you like to see its head chopped off and thrown in the lake, or what?
I don't like Sir John A. Macdonald. I don't like him at all. If you read the forwards and if you read any, but not in the interior of my book, but on the epilogues and the forwards, you know that I hate the guy. If you take away the Sir John A. Macdonald statue and you hide it, never bring it out again. 30 years from now, a kid that was born just after that statue goes, he's walking down the street, doesn't see it. And if he can't relate that story to the residential schools, he doesn't know the full story. Okay?
Right.
If you keep that statue there, that starts the conversation. A lot of people might not agree with me, but there's Indigenous people that do agree with me. And we're probably split on it. And if you need to start that conversation, but you need to put something beside it. I can't tell you too much about this, but myself and two other people have been working for, me and one fella who just brought in this lady, been working for a long time on something that we want to put there with a national figure. I'd love to be able to announce it on your podcast, but I can't. We have to keep it a secret.
No problem. I look forward to seeing what this is.
Yeah. And it's national. He's nationally known, and we've been working for a couple and a half years. You need something like that beside the statue to tell the rest of the story. You just can't go out and say, "Well, this guy." If you're a 16-year-old kid and you go up there and you read the plaque, you think, "Yeah, well, if this is all you've been taught, yeah, he saved our country from the Americans. He did this and that." But he took the land from the natives, gave it to the railroad companies, who in turn sold it to the settlers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like Hudson's Bay Company sold all the land out west for $1.5 million to McDonald, and the Cree people and all the Plains people, they didn't even know what was going on. It was their land. It's been their land forever. Somebody comes along and sells your house, and then somebody moves in the next day, you know.
Well, I think that there's something to be said for using a statue or using a landmark like that as I hate to use the term, but as a teaching moment. I think it's in Cornwall, Ontario, but there is, you know, there's a canal, and they have a plaque next to the canal that thousands of, I think, Irish immigrant workers died to build this canal.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Like, if they can put a plaque up next to a canal to commemorate the thousands of people that died to help build the canal, then surely they could put a plaque up next to Sir John A. Macdonald and tell people what an a-hole he was, right?
And all the thousands of natives that died so he can get the land out there and create Canada.
Yeah.
And like I said before, he's a white man's hero. He's not an Indigenous hero. He's not a Chinese hero.
Yeah.
He's not a black person's hero. He's a white man's hero. And you got to remember, white people like to name roads and places after people. Indigenous people, we didn't. If we walked out and we seen, oh, that's the land with the swamp in it. That's the name we gave it. We didn't name it after the guy who was walking beside us. So you have to remember, if you name something after somebody, and you don't do your due diligence 70 or 80 years out in the road, you're going to find out what this guy really was all about. And then all of a sudden you got all these problems.
Well, yeah, I mean, and yeah, exactly. You got, I mean, I don't think naming anything after a person is a good idea. No. I don't think spokespeople are great ideas. I remember Jared from Subway. That was a mistake. That was
especially when they found out who he really was.
That's exactly it. Exactly. Like, but you know, you think of other restaurant mascots, not Jared, but let's say Pita Pete from Pita Pit. I mean, Pita Pete's fictional. He's not going to do anything wrong. So it's okay. He will never, you know, he'll last forever. Why do we attach ourselves? Why do we name buildings after people? Why do we have statues of people? Why do we have Jared as a spokesperson for Subway? I'll never understand.
That guy with the beer commercial you got.
Yeah, the Alexander Keith's guy. Exactly. Yeah. He turned out to be, you know, awful stuff too, right? So.
I agree. Yeah. You've nailed it, Chris. You've definitely nailed it.
Yeah.
You have to understand but everything reverts back to the white society that they like naming things after people and then it just comes back to bite them.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't work out. Rick Revelle, I loved having you on tonight. We're going to wrap up the podcast in a few moments, but I Am Algonquin is the first of the trio that's out there. August, again, look for the new book and use some sage this summer to keep the bugs off because it legit works. I know it does because, as I mentioned, this is my best friend's dad and I'm over in your son's garage, or at least when I used to hang out with people before the pandemic, be in his garage and he just have the sage burning and I'm like, what is that smell? And he's like, it's sage, keeps the bugs away. You know, just little things like that, man.
No, I have to, before we leave, I know you want to leave. So yeah. Your last book's called Algonquin Legacy, finishes that series, comes out in August. But the book that I got coming out next, I'm excited about it because I've already got a contract signed for it.
That's amazing.
I've already got a person who wants to make a movie out of it.
There we go.
And it's called The Elk Whistle Warrior Society. There's an Easter egg at the end of Algonquin Legacy. And quickly, it's about a secret society of Native women who have their PhD and their master's. Mm-hmm. Every one of them have a black belt, and they hunt down human traffickers of Native women, murderers of Native women, and people that abuse Native children. And they do it like tough.
It sounds like a Quentin Tarantino movie. To me, please tell me it's Tarantino that wants to make a movie.
No, it's somebody that's really famous that and it's a Native woman and she's got the information and I remember she was one of my pre-readers because I sent it out to all women to pre-read.
Yeah.
He came back. She says, I've been looking for something like this all my life. You ever thought of a movie? And I said, would you like to? And she said, yes. So I can't really say her name because
That's all right.
It's an oral thing right now, nothing signed, but she was excited about it, so I'm excited about it.
People are talking, people are saying things, people are talking.
The Elk Whistle Warrior Society.
I like that. And
led by women.
Yeah, I think it's a great premise, and I think it checks all the boxes. Rick Revelle, I like to think of you as the George R.R. Martin of Indigenous writing, because you're just going to keep writing books, and they all sound even more interesting each one over. The more you discover, the more you want to share, and that's what I love about you, man.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me on the show. You're a great soul. You're a great friend to my son, and you and Patrick have always been his soul brothers. And what do you call you got a name for
yourself. The brotherhood. Yeah, that's right. It sounds more sinister than it is. It's not it's not like that other society that you've got in your fifth book.
You guys have been great friends for a long time. And I really appreciate you taking enough of me to let me ramble on.
No, Rick, pleasure was mine. And like I say, my mom will be excited to hear about the new book coming out in August. So thanks again, Rick Revelle. I Am Algonquin. You can see the lovely lit up thing in the back. And again, follow him on Twitter as well. Revelle Rick is your Twitter handle to keep up to date on all his latest writings. Really appreciate you. And we'll talk soon. Okay. See you sooner than later, I hope.
Yeah. Chris, maybe when I find out something definite about Elk Whistle Warrior Society, we'll get together. I love this book.
You know what? The fact that you're excited about it, I mean, that's the other thing too, man. Is it, you know, there's some writers who will just write to write. You write because you're passionate and you're passionate about what you're writing about, man. It's great.
I wrote it at my local bar, Longhand.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Rick Revelle, our guest. And we'll talk again possibly next week, next Thursday at 9 p.m., although I am surrounded by boxes here. I don't know if we're going to get another episode in before we move. There will be a break, a hiatus for the podcast for a number of weeks. I hope to rally for the first week of July, but I promise I'm going to try and squeeze one in next week. Guests to be announced. Thanks again, everybody.
Nick Witch.
I'm Matt Kundle, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.
Kids. I'm your eager beaver.
And I'm Mr. Grizzly.
If you love politics
or hate politics,
then have we the perfect podcast for you.
The True North Eager Beaver.
Incisive political commentary.
We keep you up to date
and give you the political and media literacy you seek
to help you
cut through the bovine fecal matter.
Facts first.
Sound analysis.
Sometimes I growl.
Sometimes I sass.
We impart civics and build community.
And we share some laughs along the way.
Being informed
and engaged has never been more fabulous.
Or sexy. Catch us on the Dean Blundell Network. Or on our YouTube channel.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Because democracy is something you do.